Session number 3966, reel number 4.
John Milne, tape number 4. Right, so you're out on patrol.
Yes, so this was really my first introduction of how adaptable and how helpful African soldiers were in every way. They knew I was a youngster on my first tour. You cannot hide anything from Africans. They've got a wonderful sense of assessment of character. Anyway, let's get on with this. So now, if you've got the picture of the company commander, the lieutenant, and myself with this company of Africans marching as quickly as we can to get to this area that had been prepared about 20 miles out from Angkor, which was going to be used as our headquarters for the next 3 weeks. So we arrived in this area. You can picture the whole company just marching through jungle tracks, bush tracks as we call them, rather than jungle, bush tracks, to get there and get settled in. And as soon as we arrived, the Africans stacked the rifles and everything, and it was amazing. They got their machetes out, which is the big knife that they have, and before you knew where you were, there they were. They'd cleared the area where the shelters were going to be built. Fortunately, of course, by being in the bush, there was plenty of wood to be cut down, and it was a joy, or really interesting and fascinating, to watch how they could use their machetes and how they could cut. They just cut the tree exactly, a branch exactly where it was wanted, so they could have these forked sticks to put in the ground. It was really amazing how adaptable and quickly, and it was all down to a drill. People were digging the holes, ready for the sticks to come into. So the time that their pals were cutting down the sticks, they say they were preparing the holes, ready for the sticks to come in. Other sticks were being cut for cross pieces, and leaves, branches were being cut for shelter. And before you knew where you were, you had this outline of, in the form of a square, of grumphers, as they're called, just shelter, because it was the dry season. There we are. They had their shelters up, and the same applied to our area where the two officers and myself, we all had a little shelter each for ourselves, where our bed and that and our sort of table and chair was placed. Anyway, within a short time, we were settled in and ready to carry on with the next 3 weeks of what we were going to do. The district officer, of course, was there. He'd gone on ahead and had primed the various village chiefs about what was happening, and also, of course, it was an opportunity for him to maintain his links and find out if there was any problems. This was my first introduction to what a district officer was doing, and it was most interesting, because at night time, wherever we were, he would be dining with us as well. I say dining with us, sitting out in the open, and he would be helping us what was happening and what was going on. It was a valuable insight of what a district officer did. It was really, I'll never forget it. But in addition to this, of course, this was all new to me. Also, this area, which I then discovered the next day, with the lieutenant, he and I, with about 8 men, went out and we were doing compass marching. We were really surveying the area. On the map, a map that they had from the survey department, you see, just showed you the main tracks between the villages. And they wanted, this was again cooperation with other things. This was through the DO. The district officer, he himself also wanted information of the area. And so this was a golden opportunity, particularly for me, to learn compass work and marching through the bush, and also field sketching, which of course went in Britain, but this was first hand and most valuable to me.
What was your role in all of this?
Well, I, with the officer, I was helping with him, and we were doing the compass marching and plotting, finding out the area, which in turn, again, was also for practice with the training of the Africans, too. But in this case, we were supplementing the sort of knowledge of the area, too, for the benefit of the district officer. And it all took time, but it was most interesting. Anyway, that's by the way. So then the next thing was we were combining from this area here. We then did every day off from there, we did marches to various villages where we gave demonstrations in the village. The district officer, he spoke the language, of course, and he told the Africans. And, of course, again, it was indirect for recruitment. And it was my job, as it happened, to arrange stage of demonstrations, as I mentioned before, of unarmed bat drill, and that's it. I could teach them it, but the Africans knew everything anyway, but I was putting it over, and especially from the firing, I had to arrange all the area where we were going to use the firing of the rifle, to show them how a rifle fired, and the machine, the Lewis gun as it was then, and using their old pots, chatties as they're called, which indicated when we had a hit. Anyway, that's by the way. But there, it was a most interesting thing because we were combining bush training, marching, and also giving these demonstrations.
What forms did the bush training take?
Well, then we were still working on the principle of flankers out, as we called it. There was the section or the platoon going on ahead, feeling its way through with people out, running parallel off the bush track to see that you wouldn't be ambushed and so on. And it was my first introduction to that type of thing. We had theory at home in Britain, but the training was much the same, only adapted to fit into the terrain. In this case, was bush training. Well, of course, you see, they knew it, and they were teaching me, although I was supposed to be in charge of a platoon. They themselves, I didn't need to. My African sergeant knew the drill. Everybody knew the drill, and they were only too pleased to help. And you must remember, I didn't know the language. You see, you had to learn Hausa, which was the language for the Nigeria regiment, and you had to learn it in your first tour and pass the test. Well, I was still within 5 weeks of being in the country, and I couldn't say I could say Sanu, which is the first greeting that anyone ever learns. But so I was trying to learn the language, but it was impossible really at that time, in the early days. But anyway, to let you have the story, there we were. The first 3 weeks I was out, and it was a wonderful insight to the adaptability and the interest and the keenness of an African soldier.
Can you remember any memorable incidents?
There was nothing much in there, because it was all, we were really training, and it was interesting to see the village life. Two, again, that was an introduction, and the main thing was how adaptable and mobile the Africans were.
Can you give me any examples of that?
Well, it's difficult. From the army point of view, it was seeing them in action, how they could scamper and disappear into the bush and move through the bush. So quietly. I mean, it was their natural habitat in so many cases anyway, and their use of settling in, making these rumphers, digging their pits for cover and so on. This match is a wonderful thing.
Did they enjoy being out on patrol?
They do love it, and they love to do drill, like in all these villages. It was a golden opportunity to show their other African brothers how good they were, sort of thing, really. And they took a pride in it.
Did you said earlier on that these were also indirect recruiting drives. Did you get, after this patrol, more recruits?
From there I couldn't know, because I'll continue my story and you'll see what happens, you see. Anyway, we did this 3 weeks. To me, that was a valuable insight. I'll get it. in every way. And again, with having contact with with this district officer too. We then returned to barracks, where I thought now we are settling in for the usual training and so on in the barracks. Soon as I arrived, my CQMS or the CQMS said, right, I'm off now, I'm due for leave, cheerio, it was his last tour, you're now in charge of everything. So of course I'd have partly had a look round the stores before going and going, it's 3 weeks thing, but now 3 weeks trek, now I was back in charge. So there was I, CQMS, CSM, everything rolled in one, in charge of the stores, and had to take over the stores officially. I then, in taking over the stores, I took over the only time in my life I had all the equipment for a gallows. Here, in this, if you could picture, there was the guard room, which was a sort of one side of this square. There was two other buildings, which were the buildings with the stores and everything like that. And then there was another building where the guard room and everything, all the other troops were stationed. And right in the middle there was the gallows. A little bit farther along the road there was where the local African police had their sort of little barracks, and which they sort of covered that area. But there was this gallows which was in the charge of the commanding officer. But the district officer was responsible for seeing the hanging and all the remains of it. I didn't see a hanging then, but there were six. By the time I left, there were six people waiting for the sentences to be confirmed. So I didn't see a hanging there. But my job, the short time that I was there, was to check this every month and submit a report that the gallows was in working order. As you walked into the store, the store door opened back. It was only when you were inside the store and you closed the door that you then saw all the equipment getting to the gallows stacked neatly behind this door for testing purposes, leather strap to keep the prisoner or the chap that was going to be hanged tight, and so on like that. And there was many stories told about hangings, but anyway, I won't repeat those. I didn't see a hanging, so I'm glad anyway too. But anyway, that was a piece of equipment that wasn't military, but it was on our list. Right, now, life in the outstation. This was most interesting. The barracks, if you can visualise all these mud houses in rows with thatched roofs, glass roofs and so on like that. This was my introduction to wives. Africans had their wives. So you were responsible to keep a list of the wives and the children. And they were all given identity disc, the same as the soldiers had, with a name and a number on it. So you had a list of all the wives and children. You were responsible for them, in my case, I was the sergeant major and everything rolled in one. It was very interesting too. Each barracks had a little place, which was run by the wives of the soldiers. Because they were clear of any African villages. Our main thing was, you see, that we were very conscious of hygiene and sanitation in all outs, and of course in regimental headquarters as well. But here you were completely on your own and you were self-contained. And it was a very high priority for sanitation, hygiene and everything, and keeping your troops medically fit. So we had this little marketplace which was clear of the barracks, where the wives run their own little market and did the cooking for the troops, because the African soldiers, they were given a ration allowance, but they were responsible for feeding themselves.
Did they have their own accommodation?
They on accommodation with this little grass, with this little mud house. So each African soldier had his little mud house and where he kept his equipment, and his own bed and things like that.
And the wives did the cooking?
The wives did the cooking, but you see, where the single ones, they bought their food and everything in this little marketplace. So not only did you have the supervision of the barracks, you were also, it was your job, which you took an interest in, and you also took an interest in the marketplace to see that the marketplace was kept clean and tidy, and the food was being cooked all right. They knew more about the cooking anyway, but it was very interesting to see how they cooked and how the various foods that the African soldiers ate and so on like that.
What was that diet composed of?
Well, usually of a stew type of thing, but made either from groundnut oil or palm oil. Yams was the basic thing, and chickens and so on, but there was various, they had various types of foods, but primarily there was more of a stew form with yams. And anyway, that was, by the way, so...
Did you supervise this to keep a check that they were getting the right sorts?
No, we didn't. We left it entirely up to them at this stage, and this was all new to me, but I learnt more as I sort of progressed in later on in later years. But this was my first introduction. But there was, again, documentation and everything was so important, and this included the wives and the children as well.
Did you get to know the wives well?
Oh yes, yes you did, because the system was in the middle of the week, the Mohammedan Sunday, Friday, it was Thursday in the early days, then it was changed to Friday. I don't know why it was Thursday originally, but it was a Thursday. There was no parades. It was the Mohammedan Sunday. So, but that day was used for all the various sort of maintenance type of work to be done. The troops that weren't on parade, but they did all their maintenance work, cleaning up the barracks and so on. And this was what we called dry pot inspection. And this was your responsibility as a sergeant major. You inspected all the barracks, and everything was turned out from their house. So you were able to, it wasn't like a kit inspection, but everything was out, and all pots and pans and everything were turned over so there was no water left lying about, which breeded mosquitoes. This was the idea, and was called dry pot inspection. So you went round the barracks and checked and everything, cooking areas, to see that everything really had been literally turned over and there was no stagnant water about. And also it was an opportunity for you to go inside the house and see that everything was sort of reasonable, well, clean as best it could be. And again, nothing sort of that would be liable to be for infection. It was very important because there were so many diseases one could have, particularly poliomyelitis, CSM as we always called it. We had to be very careful because, and smallpox, anything, there might be an infection, and before you knew where you were, the whole lot were down. That didn't affect us much because, of course, we in the army, we had systems of vaccinations and injections and so on, which was also part and parcel of the monthly treatment. We had monthly inspections for venereal disease. It was always a surprise. The troops never knew when it was going to be. This was one point that we had to be very conscious about.
Did you have any problems with venereal disease at all?
Very little, really, on the whole. Once the Africans were in and trained, they didn't want to be, because, I mean, they lost the pay and all this sort of thing, you see. So, but we had to have it. Anyway, that was just by the way. So this was my first introduction to that extra job that you were doing as the European. You did all the paperwork for pay and stores and everything like that.
What was the role of your African NCO then?
The African NCOs did everything appertaining to training. They were just the same. The sergeant major in the company, and he was responsible for all the drill and everything. Platoon sergeants were the same, and they were all trained up specifically for drill, weapon training and everything like that. And you were supervising all that and were responsible for the training too. You see, training the NCOs and weapon training and of course drill and of course naturally bush warfare and so on like that.
To come back to the wives again, where did the soldiers get their wives from? Locally or from their home villages?
No, usually they came from their own tribes. But there were cases where, of course, naturally, you see what happened then, you see various Africans, they gathered round where the military outstations were, and they made their way, their wives would make their way there in preparation, but of course they had to be past fit and they had to have a certain amount of service, I forget the details now, and before they could have a wife, with the exception of one tribe called the Dakakeris, which I'll deal with later on. I've mentioned it now. The Dakakeris, this was a special tribe. They had a form whereby they had to serve 7 years. If you wanted a wife, you see, your family and their family agreed, but you, as the young man, had over a period of 7 years to go and work on the farm of your intended father-in-law, parents-in-law. Well, when we recruited Dakakeris, this was a problem, because you see that quite a lot of young men wanted to be in the army, but of course they hadn't done what was called Gwalma. Now, to overcome that, you see, again, this was again cooperation and understanding by the district officers of the area. To overcome that, they introduced this system whereby, in lieu of working the unexpired portion of your Gwalma, say 3 years or 5 years, by the time this time you were 18 years old or something like that, you see, you then paid an amount of money in lieu of the service you would have worked on the farm. And that was worked out by the district officer and put on a contract, as one would say. And so therefore you had these young recruits coming in to the army with this Gwalma that they had to pay off during the time that they were serving in the army, which meant that they had to, took them about 2 or 3 years to pay it off anyway. So every month their allotment, as you would say, was sent to the district officer, and he in turn paid it to the prospective parent-in-laws, and this was called Gwalma. So you had this system in the army. You were more conscious of that in when you were in the depot, which brought, I'm coming to next, really, which was quite a surprise. Anyway, this was one system that had, was done with the cooperation of district officers, tribal chiefs, parents, and so on, and we were able then to have these, the very good soldiers, the Dakakeris, and they were able to come in the army and pay off and buy the wives, as you would say. Right.
Did many of them have more than one wife, being Mohammedans?
Not really. It was only the sergeants and sergeant majors in particular, because they were expensive items anyway. So you did have two wives, but again, usually it was when you were a senior rank.
Who was in charge of the wives, as it were? Did you have a head woman?
Yes. Now, this was, again, very interesting, too. Among the wives, they had a head woman, which was called a Magadja. And she was voted by the wives. It wasn't necessarily the sergeant major's wife or a sergeant's wife. It could be a private's wife. It depended entirely on who they thought would be the best person for them. It was really a mother figure. And she was in charge of the wives and responsible to see that the marketplace and various any grievances and that was brought to your notice. She would come to me if there was any problems, and that would be explained, and we would help things out. And she was a valuable asset to the running of the wives.
Why was that?
Well, she was able to sort of know what was going on and help them with their own problems, if there was any problems. And she was really, and Mike, and the ones that I knew, they were really wonderful persons, really motherly souls, and very far-seeing. You see, in Africa, age, in this country, I'm afraid when you're old, you're beyond things. But there, they respect age. And you usually found that your Magadja was one of the older persons who could be respected.
Do any of them stand out in your memory at all?
In fact, all the Magadjas that I was dealt with, I had, yes. I've got one, in fact, I've got two photographs in particular, but they were wonderful people. And then, as I was talking about the dry port inspection, you see, they were very helpful then when you went round barracks, because they went round with you. This is when the Magadja came into her own on the dry port inspection day, because she walked round with you as a sergeant major would be.
Was she dressed in a type of uniform?
Not on the dry port inspection day, but on Saturday when we had kit inspection, when then everything was then lined up and everybody was in their best, because the troops were in their best uniform, and all the kit was laid out in line in front, so you could check their equipment and that. All the women, the wives, they were all in their best, standing at the end of the lines. They weren't at their house, they were standing at the end, and the Megangia was there with her uniform. Usually it was her sort of skirt effect, cloth, the lower part was all her cloth, but she had a khaki tunic, the same as the sergeant major had, or the troops had, but it was so designed to fit her, and she had a sash, which was the opposite way from the troops, and in some cases you give him a little medal if you wanted to. It's entirely up to you, but she was very proud of the fact, and she was dressed up, and her uniform was starched and everything just as good as the troops were. But anyway, that was the sort of the atmosphere and the feeling. Everybody counted.
What happened to the children of the troops during the day?
Well, they were sort of usually playing about in the barracks, and they were used. Of course, they were very handy for carrying things and helping in the market and so on like that. But where there was, like in the headquarters stations in particular, you had a malam, and they would then go to the Quran school too. So if they were Mohammedans, they were then, that was one of the sidelines that the malam had, and he would take them on a Quran school. But of course, we found in outstations, you didn't need a malam, because you'll find that possibly the sergeant major, or one of the sergeants in particular, of course, majority were Mohammedans, and of course, they, in their own right, were malams. And quite a number of them, I would say, they were very gifted people, too. So, of course, they, whoever was the best one, would act as the malam to the company.
So would the children be given any form of education?
That again was done in their own time, in the afternoons.
How long were you at AMPA for?
Well, now, again, I thought I was going to be there for quite a while and was busy getting on. We had all the various routine work that we were doing. It's happened in March, the 17th of March I was there, which was regimental day. So right throughout Nigeria on the 17th of March, I don't know why they selected the 17th of March, it was St. Patrick's Day, but that was when all the regiment had a regimental parade. It was the regimental parade day. Well, of course, in an outstation, it was an ideal opportunity for the troops to march past and really do their drill. And of course, the local villagers were invited to come and watch. So they had this special parade when the parade was formed up and inspected, just like what the king would do. There, in this case, of course, the district officer took the salute, and as I mentioned earlier on, he had the MC and DFC from World War One, and of course, what finer man could you have to represent the King of England?